Let me take this opportunity to welcome everyone and to offer a few thank yous. First and foremost, we want to thank our hosts, the Bittmans. Bittman, thank you very much for generously opening up your home. We also want to take this opportunity to thank our tag team, there you go, of people who've been helping involved in the coordination of the series as we have had in previous years. I want to take the opportunity to thank our chair of adult ed, Ellie Lassen, for all of his work, as well as Pam Lehman, who happens to be on vacation, so she's not here this week, but Pam has always been very involved in helping coordinating the different host homes, and we appreciate Pam for her work. And I also want to thank Yocheved Roth, who was on her way on vacation this evening, who made the very attractive flyer that you may have seen in the hallway of the shul, or you should have all received in a mailing. So thank you to everyone who collaborated to help put this together. And Yemir Hashem, this evening and the next 2 weeks, we will have what I hope will be a meaningful and stimulating opportunity to share some words of Torah and to study together a topic which is both timely and timeless. As I kind of indicated in the series title, which is on your cover sheet, there's definitely something contemporary about our topic, and in a certain sense, there's definitely something controversial about the topic. What I would like to do at the outset is to address, or just acknowledge, I should say, both what is contemporary and what is controversial, but hopefully do my best to avoid either of those two things for the most part the next 3 weeks. In other words, what I would actually like to do is really roll up our sleeves and study the real Torah and the real content, which will hopefully inform some of the issues. As I alluded to this morning in Shul, when you talk about this topic, there's a lot of heat. I hope to contribute more light than heat, as the saying goes, to actually discuss some substance. But just to give you, just off the top of my head, some of the recent episodes that have generated controversy in the last year. There was, for example, a well-known situation in Eretz Yisrael not long ago where a Beis Din, I think it was in Ashdod, ruled that someone who had thought that they were a convert for I'm not sure how many years, they decided that in hindsight that this person was no longer a good convert. That was one case. Right, she came for a divorce, and they said, you don't need one anymore because you're not Jewish. That was one recent example which caused a whole upheaval. Not long ago, there was a conference about an hour south of here in Washington, D.C., of an organization which was purporting, and I use that word in quotes, to be offering a universal standard for conversion. They claim a higher standard, and in so doing managed to offend almost everybody, and at the same time, shortly thereafter, have one of the most respected Batei Din in the Haredi world in Israel condemn them, even though they had been waving the banner of Haredi standards. So that was another very recent controversy. I am affiliated, unapologetically, I'm affiliated with the RCA, and the RCA has been going through, how shall I say, a dance with the Rabbanut in Israel for over a year now, maybe it's even a little bit longer, on this issue. The Rabbanut has been looking to consolidate. You get my last thrust book. After that, people have to share. Consolidate standards for conversion, and there have been issues and charges levied back and forth. Perhaps this is Israel trying to take over America, people feeling that their gerus has been somehow questioned. We've had cases where people feel that if they're converted or they've been living as a Jew, and even if they had an Orthodox conversion, perhaps if they would move to Israel, they wouldn't have their conversion recognized. And even within the RCA, I can tell you, especially when we get to our last topic in 2 weeks, which will be the issue which is perhaps the most sensitive, which is when couples adopt children or have to convert children, which is its own halachic complications. So I was myself witness to a very passionate give and take at the last RCA convention, where different members arguing for very different perspectives, both in terms of what standards should be used and a large question of whether there should be objective standards or it should be more subjective. A lot of issues, and the truth of the matter is that as much as it's contemporary and there's been some recent controversies, I just listed very, very few of them, it's really been raging for many years in different contexts. The Mi Yehudi question in Israel in its time, who was a Jew, was a major issue when the Russians and the Ethiopians both had their mass aliyah to Israel, which was certainly wonderful, but it raised all sorts of issues about status of conversion and personal status and things such as that. And there's a book which I'll actually be quoting an article from later in this year, which came out almost 20 years ago in 1990, and that book already was entitled The Conversion Crisis. So this was one of these topics which has always been very sensitive and has always had some level of complications. So what I'd like to do, as I said, in the next few weeks, beginning this evening, is try to shed some light, try to get some understanding of some of the issues. I'm sure that next time you see a news article or something like this, we're all titillated by the same kind of things, and if we see controversy, machlokas, condemnation, so our eyes seem to go towards that. I don't imagine that will change, but at least this way, when we'll read these articles or see these reports, hopefully we'll be a little bit more educated and we'll understand the issues. Just as by way of personal disclosure, ironically enough, on a practical level, I have limited, but only limited experience, because the truth of the matter is, as I was talking to someone at Shalosh Shudas this evening, in bigger communities such as Baltimore, and especially within Baltimore, in our shul, I have very little traffic of people coming to me who want to convert. There are many Rabbanim, whether they're in shuls in Baltimore or more likely in smaller communities, where it's a humongous part of their rabbinate. Humongous part of the rabbinate of people coming in either who think they're Jewish, and then you have to deal with that, or people who want to be Jewish and spending their time. So the truth of it is, on that level, I have had some experience here, and I had some experience before I moved here, and the truth of the matter is that perhaps we'll get to it at a later point, but one of the recent things that the RCA has done in conjunction with the Rabbanut is make what they call regional Batei Din, and I have been asked, and so far at least once have served on the regional Bez Din, which is for Washington and Virginia, and Maryland. I went to Silver Spring once a few months ago to work on something in that regard. But this has always, I shouldn't say always, long been a topic of interest to me. And in fact, a number of years ago when I was the summer rabbi in Riverdale, so for those that 8-week period, my Shabbos afternoon shiur there was on halachic topics of Geirus. That's 6 summers ago, I guess it was, and it was an interest before then, and it's been an interest since then, and I look forward to this opportunity, as I was reviewing some of the things and learning new things myself, to share them with you. What I want to do is break up our series into three components, and the order, as you'll see in a moment, is very deliberate. The first topic, which will be tonight's topic, the beginning really is an introduction we'll get to, has to do with what is supposed to be our attitude towards Gerim, towards converts, an understanding of the process of conversion, even from a philosophical perspective. And then I really want to focus the bulk of our time this evening on the very important, and really this is ultimately the million-dollar question, which, as we'll see, the other topics will all hinge on, is the question of the role of Kabbalah Samitzvos, the idea that when you convert, perhaps, we'll have to see how the correct formulation is, a part, the part, an ideal, a necessary, an essential component of the conversion is for the prospective convert to accept mitzvos, the lifestyle of mitzvos, and the obligation of mitzvos upon themselves. What role that plays, how important that is, to what extent is it the wiggle room in that area, that is everything, because, certainly relating to what's both contemporary and controversial. Because the truth of the matter is that if you have a very sincere, very knowledgeable person who wants to convert, there's almost no shilas. All of the shilas and all the controversy we're usually talking about, almost all, sometimes the controversy is about who the rabbi is who's doing the conversion. But for the most part, it has to do with less than ideal situations where either the motivation or the level of observance of the ger is clearly less than ideal. Sometimes the facts are debated, but assuming that the facts are not debated, the question is, so where's the bar which above which is ideal but not necessary, and below which is absolutely crucial? And that will relate, among many other things, to the two topics which I hope to devote individual lectures to the next 2 weeks. Next week, the topic which is by far the single most common question, by far, which is people's converting because they want to marry a Jewish spouse. I think if you added up all the conversions in the world, certainly in America, by far more are motivated by marriage than everything else combined, by far. And then the one, which will be in 2 weeks, Yemir Hashem, will be the issue of converting minors, children. And again, of course, there's two cases there. Sometimes you have children who are converting along with their parents, and then other times you have children who are converting alone. For example, a typical situation would be if a Jewish family is adopting a child born to non-Jewish parents. In both of those cases, very different, but both for their own reasons have questions of this idea of acceptance of mitzvos, of kabbalat mitzvos. In the case of motivation for marriage, so the issue of sincerity is called into question. And in the case of the children may or may not know what's going on or be sincere. Even if they're old enough to know what's going on, children halachically are not considered of maturity, of age, where they can accept responsibility, and they may in fact be little children. So in what meaningful sense can there be conversion of children? And of course the question which is the most sensitive and controversial is what happens when you have parents who themselves are not Shomer Shabbos, are themselves not fully observant, and they want to adopt children. How does that interplay? Okay, so that is our game plan. I feel bad that you're both sitting there. There's a chair here. I won't be sitting there.
Can you hear me well?
Can you hear me, John?
Yes.
But I have my back to you.
Okay.
Okay, but you just mean that everybody's looking at the two of you, so if you nod off, everyone will see.
I figure almost everyone.
Okay. Okay, so let's begin, and I want to just spend now a few minutes going through, since it's not the primary focus. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. A few minutes discussing the Torah and Chazal's attitude towards Gerim, because unfortunately it's not new in our generation. It's been a perennial challenge. We don't always, as a community, live up to the ideals of the Torah. So just to start in the beginning, in the most appropriate place, the first source you have on your sheet is a very straightforward pasuk. V'ahavtem es hager, ki gerim hayisem be'eretz Mitzrayim. There's a mitzvah in the Torah that as Jews we are supposed to love the gerim in our community. And we are reminded, as we have to be, that you know you shouldn't think, what's the implication here? You shouldn't think you're any better. Because after all, in essence, we're all gerim, we all have to go, and the truth is, that is not just hyperbole. The halachos, which we are not going to have time to get through, obviously even three classes is not nearly enough to go through everything, the halachos of what constitutes a conversion, what parts of the process are required, going to the mikvah, bris milah for a man, etc., those are all learned out from the generations of the story that we're reading about in the Torah, the generation that left Egypt, the bris milah they had then, they had the mikvah before Har Sinai. That's how the Gemara learns out the process of conversion. So this pasuk is not just hyperbole. Ki geirim ha'yisem be'eretz Mitzrayim. When we left Mitzrayim, in essence, we were going through a conversion, and therefore we're reminded, so to speak, of our roots, and we should therefore, in that sense, not be in any way discriminatory. Oh, I'm fine. No, I'm fine. It's better that way. Thank you. The Rambam actually, not all Rishonim do, but the Rambam quotes this pasuk as the source of an independent mitzvah. One of the 613 mitzvos, according to the Rambam, is exactly this mitzvah of Yahavtem Asager. The Rambam says it here. He counts it as this 207th positive mitzvah. It's mitzvah Asay Reish Zion. And the Rambam tells us a very important point, that even though, of course, a ger is a full-fledged Jew, and we have a pasuk, v'yahavta l'rayacha kamocha, we're supposed to love all Jews, all of our neighbors. So why do I need an extra pasuk, v'yahavta as a ger? Don't I already know I have to love them because they're v'yahavta l'rayacha kamocha? Says the Rambam, yes! But this is to reinforce it. And in fact, there's two mitzvos. If you show proper love and respect and friendliness to a ger, you actually fulfill two mitzvos. And if you don't, you are in violation of at least two, and perhaps more. We'll see in a few moments. But the Rambam goes out of his way to say, in fact, that yes, it's true, v'yahavta l'rayacha kamocha is relevant, but it really goes beyond that. Furthermore, the Rambam at the end of this source makes a point, which is further highlighted by the third source, which is a medrash, which is that the psukim and chazal see in the similarity of the language actually compare the love that we have for Hashem with the love that we are supposed to demonstrate to a ger. And the Rambam makes the point at the end, and here this Medrash, and we'll see in a few moments, in a minute, other Medrashim as well, make that point. For example, the Medrash Tanchuma in Lech Lecha speaks about Kama Chaviv Hager Shenizgayer Miyisrael Ba'amidasan Al Har Sinai. That in fact, in a certain sense, a ger is more beloved to Hashem than other Jews are. Why? Because Har Sinai, which we'll be reading about next week, so as much as there was a Nasa of Nishma, there was a volitional acceptance of the Torah, but we know there was the fire and light show that went on with Har Sinai. You could hear the lightning and see the thunder, and it was all scary stuff going on. And there was a certain wow, and perhaps even intimidation factor, which led to our acceptance of the Torah, or our whole conversion process that culminated in Har Sinai. As opposed to, says the Medrash, reading the last underlined part, Zeh shelo ra echad mehem, but the ger who wasn't there, v'hishlim atzmo l'Kadosh Baruch Hu, and nevertheless, without that wow, fire and light show, still decides to join the Jewish people, v'kibul alav malchus shamayim, yesh lo chachaviv mizeh, could there be anyone or any people who are more beloved than that? It's interesting that the Medrash, if you'll skip the next source for a second and go to the following two sources, the Medrash in the Sifrei says that our attitude in a certain sense towards Gerim is reflected or is a measuring stick of our love of Hashem. In what sense? So imagine I look at this, I went away to camp at times when I didn't know people, and I went away to two different high schools where I really didn't know people when I got to each of those high schools. Now when you go to a new place, sometimes you have, let's say, one friend, like, you know, you're already in, you know one person, but you don't really know anybody else. So what is often, hopefully, the instinct of the one friend that you have when you go to the new sleepaway camp or to the new school? What do they do? Not just because they're nice and they want to help you, but there's a certain instinct. If I like him, I really like her, I want other people to know how good a guy she is, how great a girl she is. I want other people to like them too. There's a certain human instinct. I've experienced that. I've been on both ends of that. Thankfully, I've been the recipient of kindness, and because of that, I've tried to reciprocate when it's been my turn, and I knew somebody coming new. You want people to meet them. Oh, yeah, meet so-and-so. They're such... So the Medrash, and the Rambam elaborates on that, says that that psychological fact is such a truism that it's also a barometer for our love of Hashem. If we really love Hashem, so what's the human instinct? If we really love Hashem, and it's not just, you know, talk. We want other people to love Hashem. Who is the greatest exemplar of that, says the Rambam? Avraham Avinu, who the Navi refers to among all of the other biblical heroes as Ohavai, the one Hashem's beloved. So the Medrash says, therefore, if you take a look at the Sifrei, V'ahavtas Hashem Elokecha, you're supposed to love Hashem, Ahavehu al Habrios, Avraham Avichu, make Hashem beloved to others like Avraham. How do we know that Avraham did it? So the Pasuk tells us, Hanefesh Asher Asu Bacharan, Malamed Shaya Avram Avinu Megayrim Umachnisim Tachas Kanfei Shechina. Right? That because Avram went out and, in his particular case, proselytized, he showed people the love of God and got them to accept it and buy in, that was the ultimate demonstration of his love of Hashem. So too, we are called upon to follow Avram's model. And even if it doesn't necessarily mean proselytizing in the same way that Avram did, but bringing people to the love of Hashem is certainly one thing, and people who've already themselves come to that love of Hashem, in other words, Gerim who are coming to the community, so certainly, as the Medrash Tanchuma says, all the more so we should have respect for them and show them that love as well. Until now, I've been speaking in the positive sense. I do want to mention there's a very famous Gemara, which I alluded to, which notes that if one is not nice, is unfriendly, or perhaps worse, mean-spirited to a ger, that beyond some of the obvious Yahafle Rincha Kamocha problems, there are particular and special averos that condemn such behavior. The Gemara in Bava Metzia of all places, this is like classic Talmudic jigsaw puzzle. This is the last place you might have expected it. However, the Gemara in Bava Metzia, which is dealing with commercial law, is discussing a halacha called Ona'a. Ona'a actually wears two hats. One interpersonal and one financial or commercial. So the original context is the financial and the commercial context, which is that in certain extreme cases, overcharging or taking advantage of people financially is a violation. Without getting into a completely other topic, which would be a fascinating lecture series, it seems, at least in the biblical model, that we do not believe in completely free markets. I wouldn't say that we're against free markets, but completely free markets, the idea that if all of a sudden, you know, there's a hurricane and therefore there's a run on generators and therefore you can charge, you know, exorbitant amounts. So the Torah doesn't necessarily take that as one example, perhaps, friendly on such behavior. Certain price gouging is a violation. It's a Torah prohibition. Even if the person pays you voluntarily, there's still a prohibition. It's called ona'as ma'mon. You're flipping someone financially. However, the Gemara points out that there are also psukim that tell us there's another thing, and it's fascinating that the Torah uses the same language for it, ona'as dvarim, not financial at all, but verbally, to afflict someone, to hurt somebody with words, is its own avera. So in light of that, says the Gemara, it's one thing if you do that to your fellow Jew, but if you do it to a fellow Jew who is actually a ger tzedek, convert, so not only are you a violation of the regular quote-unquote prohibition of ona'a, of hurting somebody's feelings, but you violate at least two other averos. And in fact, if you take a look at the source, the Gemara Bava Metzia says, Hama'ane es hager over b'shloshe lavin. The Gemara talks about something called the lochitz, which is a discussion in the Mishnah of what that means. Let's leave that out for a moment. But Hama'ana, you have any kind of verbal affliction, you make fun of them, you mean to them, your violation of three. And in fact, the Gemara quotes the psukim. The third one is the general one, but there's two other specific ones. V'chiyogor itcha ger ba'artzchem lo sonu oso. A ger is living within you, meaning join the community. Lo sonu, do not afflict him. And furthermore, the one before that, the ger lo sona. You should not afflict the ger. So the Gemara says there's at least three prohibitions, perhaps even more. What do I mean by perhaps? Because the Gemara, in a very well-known rhetorical, perhaps hyperbole, perhaps not, the Gemara concludes this discussion where I have it underlined and says a remarkable thing. It's not just three averos, but rather Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol Omer on the last line, if Neimah Hizhira HaTorah B'Shloshe B'Shisha Makomos. 36 times. Others say Arbaim Vashisha. 46 times. Mitzkomos Begir Mitznesha Suro Ra. What does that mean? So the Gemara says, and again this is quoted by some, that if one were to afflict and to make fun of a ger, so then they may be a violation of 36 averos for one action. Maybe 46. Now where do you get 36? Where do you get 46 averos? So some of the Rishonim discuss this and they point out that if you look through the Chumash, every time it mentions the phrase ger, even if it's talking about the Jewish people as gerim, or even if it's not in a halachic context, so maybe there you get some high number, although it's not clear that you get precisely 36 or 46. So it's not clear that this is a literal Gemara, but it's certainly meant to reflect something very significant. Now it's interesting, the end of the Gemara, that last phrase, is a little bit politically incorrect. Ibnesha Suro Ro, what does that mean? That it sounds almost pejorative. It's not really, but the way some of the Mefarshim explain it, basically what they're saying is there's a certain reality which we have to always be aware of. There's a certain vulnerability that on some level, again, for some people it may be more obvious and more real, and for other people it may be very distant and unlikely, but all things being equal, there's a certain vulnerability that as much as the ger becomes one of us, a fellow Jew, but there is a reality, especially, for example, I mean, I'm adding this, it's not in the Gemara, if they converted at an adult age or an older age, and that is that they have a past. We all have pasts. And sometimes our pasts are you know, sometimes they're very similar to our present. And for some of us, our pasts were very, very different than our present lifestyle. And whenever anyone has that, and again, it's just an extreme example of that, to the extent that that is true, people's minds can wander. And at times of difficulty or frustration, they may think back in positive ways to a previous or earlier lifestyle. This is a similar, we have this, a very parallel Gemara when it comes to a Baal Tshuva, someone who's born Jewish, but wasn't observing them because the Gemara, there's a halacha, you're not supposed to remind the Baal Tshuva about their past. Why? Because there's a certain vulnerability and sensitivity that they have to that. Whether they should or shouldn't be embarrassed is beside the point. It's human nature. And in a certain sense, there's a fear that to the extent that we make things difficult for them now, so whether it's a realistic fear or not, but it's certainly possible that they may say, you know, what do I need it for? If this is how they're going to treat me, you know, I had other options. So that's what the Gemara, that's how the Mefarshim understand this Gemara as well. You're playing with fire. It's not just that you're hurting someone's feelings. On some, again, it doesn't mean that we're thinking that any minute, you know, the Ger is questioning, should I go back, should I stay? That's ridiculous. But it means that on some subtle and profound and deep level, that's that type of, again, whether it's actual tension or not might depend on the individual, but on some level, that's something that a person who goes through such a radical transformation in their life will carry with them forever. And basically what this is highlighting for us is how sensitive we are supposed to be to that. Any questions so far? Not sure what to make of that, but okay. It means that they could go in a path, in a direction. Yeah. Now, I want to spend another few minutes discussing the middle part of our shir, just to give you a taste of it. I give you the full bibliographical information here on the sheet. To me, a very remarkable article by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. It's published here in a book from 1990, but that's a collection. I don't know exactly how much earlier he originally wrote the article. It may even have been in Hebrew before it was translated. And as some of you who are familiar with him, he is a halachic and Talmudic genius, but this essay is not a halachic or Talmudic analysis. It's much more philosophical and psychological, and basically it's his attempt to describe from philosophical or psychological terms, the process of conversion in a way which he argues, and I believe convincingly, mirrors a certain duality in that conversion process, which mirrors the duality of Jewish life in general. This is something that I alluded to this morning in Shul, where I mentioned that when we learn, right, the Havdil of all of those, but if I was going to, you know, if there's a process, you know, an application process to join a country club, and they're looking for certain things. So based on the process of getting accepted, I can learn what is important to the people as a member. That's how they determine the criteria of how to get accepted. So the Havdil, so too, when we see the process of the Geirus process of conversion, so that I think it's logical, and he makes the compelling argument about the specifics, that if we understand accurately what's going on in the conversion process, that reflects in a very beautiful and profound way a reality of Jewish life in general, which is why it's particularly important, even those of us who are not Gerim, to learn these halachas, because we can learn sometimes a lot more than we might have ever realized about our own Yiddishkeit from learning about how halacha understands someone who wants to become Jewish has to become Jewish. Yes. Okay? So he makes the point, Rav Lichtenstein, in his very beautiful prose, that there's two aspects to conversion. On the one hand, he says, is the first one, profound, which he refers to as a profound revolution. In its ideal form, its root is a longing for holiness, striving for a world wholly good and wholly true. In other words, here he elaborates on the idea that Geirus is not only a revolution, but a certain personal and very private striving for holiness. In order, as part of this point, he quotes the famous Gemara, which I have here on the bottom of the sheet, which refers to a convert, a Ger Sheniskayer, Kekatan Shano Ladam. He could be 45 years old, 70 years old, and has the status on some level of a newborn. Kekatan Hano Ladam. And the truth is that there are halachic ramifications of that. relationships to parents, to biological parents, etc. But as he points out, we're not talking now about the halachic ramifications, but there's something profoundly philosophical that statement expresses. A complementary source is the source on the top of the next page, which relates to the same phenomenon which we saw before, and that is the Torah and Chazal's description of Avraham Avinu as being someone who was the father, or who created Osa Nefashos, who made souls, who created people by his proselytizing and conversion. And as the Medrash says, did Avraham create anybody? Can one human being create? The answer is no, but we can give birth. And therefore, there's a complementary source. The convert, in a certain sense, is considered like a child, like a babe. And in that sense, if you have a person, there isn't always a person, but if you have a person who is a megayer, somebody else, who is the primary teacher, who leads someone on that process, so in a certain sense, spiritually, they are considered like a parent, like someone who gave birth. Now, this idea of giving birth, of a parent, of a child, the idea that the ger himself sometimes, in a certain sense, gives birth to himself. Take off your hat. What does that reflect? So Rav Lichtenstein writes, I think, very beautifully. He says here from page 4 of his article, this principle finds expression in the simple yet famous halakha of a ger is like a newborn babe. We customarily associate it with various halakhas, etc., but he says here in the right column, these are only the consequences. But what is the actual concept? The ger returns to the source, penetrating the secrets of ontological reality, and while standing on the threshold of a new life, ruminates over the mystery of existence and is involved in a superior creation. He is born and gives birth at once. There's something very profound of self-birth, of recreating, of getting, going back to the source and recreating oneself in a very private, subjective, intimate, spiritual search and yearning. However, that's only half the story. Because after all, he says, as much as that is very private and spiritual and rebirth and all those things, there's a whole other aspect of Gavrus, which is in fact the part which is what generates most of the controversy, which is the fact that this is not just some private thing, you know, how from you are, how from he is, how from she is, you know, that's their business. When it comes to the conversion and a ger, then all of a sudden all the spiritual stuff is not just up to them and not only their business, but somehow all of us seem to think that we have a say, we care. And the answer is with good reason, because there's a whole other dimension to Gerus. To make this point, Rav Lichtenstein quotes from the Gemara in Masechta Yevamos, which points out a fact. So we take it for granted, but it's a fact, as the Gemara tells us, that because the word mishpat is used in reference to a ger in the pasuk, we learn from that that to become a convert is not something that there could just be a shulchan aruch that the person does themselves, but rather the process of Gerus requires a bezdin, and in fact it has the status of din, such that, for example, just like you're not allowed to have a din Torah at night, two people arguing over money, they're going to go to a bezdin, you can't have that case be heard at night. So too, gerus cannot be done at night, because it is mishpat, it means a bezdin. The Rambam, in a very subtle way, but he makes it really a contrast with our previous opinion. When Rambam quotes this halacha, he doesn't say anything original per se, but he contrasts it with someone who was megayer beino levein atzmo, by themselves. Now again, the reason I stress that is because we just said that there's this first very beautiful aspect that Rav Lichtenstein pointed out of Gerus, which is very much private, very personal, this subjective inner yearnings for the spiritual and the rebirth and all this beautiful stuff he spoke about. So if that's all it was, why shouldn't it be beino levein atzmo? That's a very private experience and emotions. But the answer is no. Mishpat ksivbe. There's a whole other dimension which is much more public as opposed to private, much more objective and formal as opposed to subjective. And let's just read a few snippets of Rav Lichtenstein's summary of this idea. He says there's a second aspect to Gerus, objective, formal, and communal. As he says beautifully towards the end of the paragraph, to his, the Geir's, knocking on the door, he hears a response. Let us presume that your spiritual pilgrimage has prepared you sufficiently for Geir's, but if you want to realize it, you must still follow certain steps. It's reminiscent of the famous comment from the Sefer HaKuzari, right, where the Chacham says to the Melech, yes, you have the right intentions, kavanasecha ritzuyim. You may want to do the right thing, but that's not always enough in life. ma'asecha einam ritzuyim. There's certain specific things you have to do. There's a process. It's not enough to just be sincere. It's not enough to just be inspired. That may be enough in your own private soul, but that's not enough to get done. There's something formal and objective. There are standards. As he puts it so beautifully in the next page, knocking not only on heaven's door, but also on the gates of Knesset Yisrael, the Jewish people. In other words, there's something very public and communal. You're not just becoming someone who has a completely new rebirth, a katan hanolad dami relationship with Hashem, but our understanding of the role of the Jewish people is that when a person becomes a convert, they're also becoming a member of the Jewish people. And in a certain sense, again, not equal, of course, as he says, but in a certain sense, when a person is becoming candidate for conversion, so they take upon themselves, so to speak, two standards or two people that they're, so to speak, extending. It's like a shidduch, but instead of just, you know, giving one hand, you have to give two. You're knocking on two doors, as he says. One to Hashem, the relationship now, the new relationship, but also one to the Jewish people. And the role of the Beis Din isn't just somebody or some group of Ravanim who are going to make sure that your relationship with Hashem is being established correctly, which is of course correct, but also because they're representing the community who is, if not equal, but nevertheless still a partner in the process. A ger doesn't just become a member of the chosen one in terms of relationship with Hashem, but also a relationship with all Jewish people. And our understanding of the cosmic significance of being part of the Jewish people is of such that even if it's not equal, but it's of significance to that first relationship as well. He writes really very beautifully on towards the end of the article on page 11. Just again, I just thought the imagery was powerful. Kuzinski is a beautiful writer, I'm sure you know that. The ger is eager to soar, and the three judges clip his wings. In other words, like, again, with all the inspiration of wanting to, but in ours, you still have to answer to us. Again, not in a, hopefully in a arbitrary way, or in a callous way. That's terrible when those things happen. But rather in a sense of sobering the person, so to speak. Those spiritual strivings have to be balanced with a sense of responsibility. It's interesting that Rav Lichtenstein points out this combination, subjective, the private, and the personal, spiritual on the one hand, birth, rebirth, on the other hand, communal, formal, juridic, these balancing acts are reflected in the actual aspect of Geulus. Because it's not just, again, part and parcel of a relationship with Hashem, but it's becoming part and parcel of the Jewish people. So for example, the Rambam tells us, again, paraphrasing the Gemara, that the ger is asked two different times. First, when they first come to us that they want to convert, and then afterwards, and sometimes it could be a year later where they've been studying and learning, but now they're ready to go right before they're going to go to the mikvah. Once again, they're asked, are you sure you want to do this? And the way we ask them that question is to ask them about mitzvos, that's true, but we also ask them about the Jewish people. Are you sure you want to join the Jewish people? You know, it ain't so simple to be us. We're not always living in the best of circumstances. It's part and parcel of that. Furthermore, the Rambam had a very famous tshuva to somebody named Ovadja Hager. His name was Ovadja. And the question, which starts off with somewhat technical and halachic, but becomes very, very significant, fascinating, is, you know, there are numerous mitzvos that we have in which we invoke in the first person Jewish history. One of which is more esoteric from our perspective, but certainly, hopefully won't be in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, was the mitzvah of Bikurim. When you bring the first fruits to the Beis HaMikdash and to the Kohen, right, we say Arami Ovidavi, we're familiar with the Psukim because we say them in the Pesach Seder. But we speak about Jewish history. It's actually a summary of all of Jewish history. And there were different texts about how that was done. And the question was, what if a ger will bring Bikurim? Do they speak about that as well? And there's a Mishnah in the Talmud Bavli, but there's also a parallel text in the Yerushalmi. And one version of it has a slight little change for the ger to say, as opposed to other Jews, which reflect the fact that it wasn't his or her forefathers that were the ones who were actually being chased and saved, etc. But the Rambam suggests that, in fact, there's no problem whatsoever with a ger saying the exact same nusach of a fellow Jew. Why? Because once they actually go through the process of a sincere conversion, then they don't just become Jews at this point going forward as much as anyone else, but rather our history, in a certain magical, mystical sense, becomes their history. And I have both for you in Hebrew and in English, but let me just read for you a little bit of the Hebrew because I think the language is so powerful. He starts off by saying, Ikur hadavar she'Avram avinu hu shelimed kol ha'am. It was Avram who taught everyone, taught him the mitzvos, taught him religion, theology, Hashem's unity, etc. Furthermore, I'm just going to read the underlying parts. Kol mi she'yizgayer ad sof kol ha'daros. Anyone who converts at any point in Jewish history. Anyone who accepts the unity of Hashem, Kamoshu Kasa Batara, Talmido Shalav Ravinu, Ubnei Beso Haim Kulam. They all become fully students and members of the family of Avram Avinu. Nimsa Avram Avinu Alav Hashalom, who Av Lazaro, Hakisherim Haholchim Midarachav. He is like the father, so to speak, of Al Gerim, Va'av LeTalmidav, V'chol Ger SheYiskayir. He is not only the Rebbe, but also the father, so to speak, of every Ger in some spiritual sense. And therefore, he says, getting to the upshot, last few lines, even if we won't change the text and we'll have the Ger read the exact same text as everyone else, Ein v'kach hefsed klum, says the Rambam, that doesn't bother me. Me'afar shenichnasta takas kanfei shechina. You've already come under the wings of the Shechina. You've joined the Jewish people. Ein kan hefresh beinenu ubeincha. There is no difference whatsoever between you and between us. V'chol hanisim shenasu ki'ilu lanu ulacha nasu. It's as if they were done to you and us at the same time. Harayu Omer B'Yeshaya, as the Pasuk says, he concludes, Ein shum hefresh klal beinenu, uveincha lachal davar. Now obviously there's a little bit of a rhetorical flourish, because while it's not our topic of our series, there are some minor differences about the role that a ger can have. But the Rambam is aware of that. But his point is, those are fundamentally exceptions or technicalities. Ultimately, not just in the here and now are we equal, but we really can have a shared history. And again, all of this goes to the point that there's a second aspect of Geirus. In a certain sense, it makes it more difficult, but the upshot of what's accomplished is far more ambitious and far more holistic and far more beautiful. It's not just about the personal relationship that the Ger has with Hashem. That, in a certain sense, would be easier, certainly less controversial, but it would also be much more limiting. No, that's not it. Geirus, from its process through its outcome, is a dual track, because it's also about not just coming closer to Hashem, but joining the Jewish people, not only in the here and now, but also throughout all history. And the truth of the matter is, for all of this, with all of the texts and the Rambams and the this and the that, ultimately, it all goes back to one pasuk in Tanakh. One profound pasuk, which is perhaps the most instructive story about all conversion anywhere in Tanakh. Who am I thinking of? Rus. Oh. Wouldn't you know it? It's on the source sheet. What does Rus say? This is at the beginning of the Megillah. Right? Nami is telling her, go back. You know, here I am. I'm coming back. It's all poor, impoverished. I have nothing. So what does she say? No, I'm going to stay with you. And how does she phrase her comment so beautifully? Amech ami ve'elokayach elokai. Your people is my people. Your God is my God. And in light of everything we've seen until now, these psukim take on added significance. There's something very profound in what she's saying. Because there's two aspects to being a Jew. And therefore, there's two aspects to converting, to becoming a Jew. We don't just have a relationship with Hashem, which we must, of course, but we also have a relationship and a responsibility and a common destiny with our fellow Jews. And that is something that is part and parcel of the conversion process. And again, because it's part of the conversion process, It teaches us, if we need to be taught, reminds us if we need to be reminded, whether we were born Jewish or not, all of us have to be living on that dual track. A relationship with Hashem, but a relationship with our fellow Jews. Any questions? Okay. I now want to move on, about a half an hour left. I want to focus now on the money part, so to speak. In light of all of this, which so far has just been, I hope, nice and parve, we've been focusing a lot now, especially in the last few minutes, on this second aspect. But there is a first aspect of conversion, and that is a relationship with Hashem. Now, we've been speaking about it from a philosophical or psychological perspective, but crunch time, what does that really involve, bottom line? What is expected of the convert when it comes to religious commitment, such that we could, if we can, figure out or plot out a bar above which, at least, maybe only barely, but at least above which someone has to be able to meet, below which would be considered insufficient. So the primary Talmudic text which addresses this question seems to be a Gemara in Masechta Yevamos. I have it here at the bottom of page 3, where the Gemara tells us, basically in very simplistic terms, what happens when someone knocks on the door and says, "Rabbi, I want to convert." And in fact, that's exactly how the Gemara describes it. Tanu Rabbanon, Ger Shavoli Hiskayer Bismanazen. Somebody comes to us and says, "We want to convert." What happens? So we all know, we don't just say, "Wonderful, here, make out a check and sign up." And there are some who do that, that's a problem. What are you supposed to do? We're supposed to try to, you know, dissuade them a little, but question them. Ma'ari Yisa Shabbatul Yiskayer, you know, what is your motivation? What are you doing here? Don't you know? Yeta Yodesh, Yisrael Bismanazeh, Avim Techufim, Techufim, Umetrufim, Yisurin Boimalayim, which is trying to figure out every synonym you could have to throw the thing. Don't you know it states to be one of us? Tell you how hard it is, where anti-Semites and there's pogroms and there's czars and there's holocausts and anti-Semitism is terrible, and even when we don't think it's anti-Semitism, the ADL will find anti-Semitism. I mean, you know, it's so hard to be Jewish. Why would you want to be part of us? In Omer, if he says, Yodeani, oh, I know, oh, do I know? Ve'ini chadai? But nevertheless, I'm still not worthy, you know, humbly. In other words, I still want to do it. Kablan Oso, he's proved his sincerity. What do we do next? Modiyun Oso, Mixas Mitzvahs Kalos, Mixas Mitzvahs Chamuros. We give him a little bit of a summary of mitzvahs, some of the lighter, easier ones, some of the harder ones. Modiyun Oso, Avalekit, Shukham Peah, gives some examples of mitzvahs we share with him. Modiyun Oso, Unchum Shal Mitzvahs, we tell him that, you know what, there's consequences. You can get punished if you don't do mitzvahs. After all, don't you know, I'm in the fourth line, that at this point you could have eaten shreif, achalta chelev, no problem, you can eat shreif. You could, don't have to keep Shabbos, no problem. But now, ashav, achalta chelev, onir shkarei, schilata Shabbos, onir skila. But if you transgress Shabbos, you'll have the death penalty. Furthermore, we also tell him the reward. You know, eventually, if he's still with us, if he hasn't gotten depressed, we tell him that the glass is half full as well. There's a wonderful reward for mitzvos, and you should know that it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. However, as the Gemara says, I'm at the third line from the bottom at the end, a marben alav, a medakna alav, we don't tell him too much. It's impossible. You'll be there forever. You know, it's a lifetime of learning. If we made that as a contingency to convert, no one would ever convert. But we give him this basic summary. And if he's willing to do it all, kibel, then we go through the brismila, so it's a man, we give him the brismila, then we give him the matbilin also, we take him to the mikvah, shnei tamir chachamim on the agava, we have witnesses to see everything that's happening, and again a second time, modiyun oso mikzas mitzvos kalos chamuros, tavol v'ola hari huki yisrael l'chol devarav. Okay, go through this, now again, this was 10 lines in the Gemara, this could take a year, this could take 6 months, this could take a while, but this is basically the process. They come as a candidate, we determine their sincerity, if they really prove their sincerity, then they have a process where they learn, and eventually it culminates in versmila and or tefila for a woman. Now what do we see here implicit is that there's a role of teaching them about mitzvahs. How important is that? How comprehensive is that? So take a look at the top of the next sheet, another Talmudic text. The Gemara in Bechoros tells us something really amazing and extreme. Oved kochavim shabo lekabel divrei Torah chutz meidavar echad. A non-Jew says, "I want to convert. I'm willing to accept all of the Torah, except for one thing I don't believe in." Anyone want to give me a good example? This is your way of expressing in a kosher and parv way what is the most difficult thing for you. not talking to the shul. Okay, getting up for chakras. The men should be sensitive to that, right? Okay, so you know, I'm with you on that. I'm willing to do everything, but I mincha is going to be my first tefillah of the day. I can't do it. Yeah. So says the Gemara, ein makabelin oso. And just to give right on your point, they make the point explicitly at the end of the Gemara. I feel like I come a different sofrim, even if it be rabbinic as well. I keep all the Torah commandments, but you know, the rabbis made up the text of the Siddur anyway. So I can't hold of that. That's too much for me. You know, Kriyas HaTorah is just too long, and anyway, who made up that rule? We have to read the Torah once a week. You know, everything else I'll do. I won't even wear shatnez and, you know, a Chol of Yisrael and everything but one, says the Gemara. Says this, what is the popular saying? 99% kosher is 100% treif. Right? It's all or nothing. Now, it's interesting. If that's true, if we have this comprehensive requirement for accepting mitzvos, who can think of a Gemara which seemingly calls this into question? Right, this certainly implies a certain sincerity. I'm going to do all the mitzvot, no other agenda.
All the Jews.
If you get born in, right? There's a famous story actually about a rebbe. One of the Hasidish rebbes became rebbe at a young age. So the elder men in the community said, "How it's not fair. We've been spending our whole life." She said, "I'll tell you. There was once a group of mountain climbers that wanted to climb to the top of a mountain. So they struggled and they put on their gear and they schlepped up, and it was days and weeks in sub-zero freezing weather. And they finally got to the top of the mountain and they see some little kids kicking around a soccer ball. I said, "Well, how did you get here?" I said, "Well, don't you understand? You had to climb up. We were born here." There's always an advantage of being born there. In other words, we don't say this about a Jew. We don't say if you don't accept everything, you're not Jewish anymore, right? If you're born a Jew, you're always a Jew. If the question is when you want to become a Jew, we have standards to make it. What seems to go against the grain of this Gemara is the well-known three stories that the Gemara Masechta Shabbos tells us about Hillel and Shammai, right? The convert who came and said, "Teach me all the Torah on one leg." Now, how much did he teach him? He just taught him Yahav L'Reicha Kamocha, the golden rule. Convert me so that I can become Kohen Gadol. Right, that doesn't sound like someone who's really...
The way of
God. Right, well, that's how they talked. But that's later, after the rest of the Gemara. He understood that he couldn't do it. But the point is, Hillel accepted him then. Shammai seems to take the hard line. Shammai always says, "No, if you're not really having acceptance of mitzvahs, I don't want you." But Hillel, who we usually Potskin like, Hillel always accepts him. So the truth is that both Rashi and Tosfos are both bothered by this, and even though I don't want to spend time on it, but I put down Rashi and Tosfos on the sheet, they both more or less give the same answer, that in those cases, Hillel knew that even there was a certain basic commitment now, and he was confident that over the course of the process of him teaching him, he would get there by the end. So even though it looked like the person was disingenuous or unserious about his commitment at the outset, but Hillel had faith in his own teaching powers and the person's sincerity that he would get there. Shammai was looking at things at face value. If you don't have the right attitude or commitment now, I'm not willing to accept you. But the truth of the matter is that Hillel's behavior has led to a certain subjectivity in Geirus, the Shach. One of the great commentaries on Shulchan Aruch, here I have it on the source sheet. The Shach says, you see from this story, Mikan, Yishlomod, Tahakol Lefi Ra'os Eni HaBezdin. That there are certain things that you can't put down in a book, in a Shulchan Aruch, or in a Shilas and Shuvas, which are going to cover every single scenario. Certain things are going to come up, which the rabbis, the Bezdin in question, are going to have to make a judgment call, and it's really not fair for someone at the same time, or let alone later, to second guess them. Because certain things, now again, the boogeyman is in the details. It's certain things. Right? Certain things are so obvious and are such red flags that we would have people who would say, "No, not good. Yes, it is good." But other things are more subjective, and it's just impossible if you're not there to make the judgment call. What's the proof? Hillel himself. Right? If we were looking at this case, we just heard about somebody like this, we would say, "How could you accept the person?" And yet Hillel was willing to accept him because he, in the moment, made a judgment call that it would work. So there's a certain subjectivity that has to be there. The bottom line, though, is these are certainly exceptional cases with Hillel, but what we saw from that first Gemara is that there certainly seems to be a certain idea of knowing mitzvos and accepting mitzvos as part of the role of Geirus. In fact, Tosfos here on your sheet, Tosfos says the following. You know, we mentioned before that you need a Bezdin, right? The role of the Bezdin in the Geirus. Let's say you don't have Bezdin for the whole process. Let's say if somebody did a bris milah without a Bezdin. But I was part of the Beis Din locally when we did a Bris Mila. Right? But let's say the Beis Din wasn't there. Is it good or is it not? Let's say there was no Beis Din at the mikvah. Right? Let's say it was a woman, she went with the mikvah lady, there was no rabbis there. Just as an aside, I hope it's obvious, but even if it's not, there's a whole process, very much medactic on Sneus, for how the Rabbanim can be there. But nevertheless, on some level, the Rabbanim are there, I had to do that as well, for the mikvah, whether it be a woman or a man. But the bottom line is, let's say they're not there. So this is a huge discussion in the Rishonim. Does the Bezin have to be there for all of the Geiris, only parts of it? Ideally, of course, all of it. But anyway, the bottom line is, in that discussion, Tosfos is of the opinion that for the mikvah, or for the Bris Mila, but if they weren't there, it could be okay. One thing, though, absolutely needs the Beis Din. And what is that? Says the Tosfos. Kabbalah Samitzvos. Hi, the Be'ina Shalosha, the Kabbalah Samitzvos, Avalola Tzvila. If you don't have a Beis Din who goes through the process and can attest that the convert has accepted the responsibility of mitzvos, there is no conversion. That is how Tosfos rules. And what's more important than Tosfos is that the Shulchan Aruch paskins like this Tosfos. Take a look at the Shulchan Aruch. He tells us at the bottom of his statement, you need a Beis Din ideally, and even with Yeved, it could be okay without a Beis Din. Chutz mikabalas hamitzvos, shema keves, emeina b'yom u'b'shlosha. Why is that the one that needs a Beis Din above all else? The Taz tells us, Shizahu guf hadavar v'hat chalosa. It's an essential component to the Geiris, and therefore the Tefillah or the Mila, if we know it happened, maybe we'll be okay with it, even if the Beis Din see. It's not ideal, but in certain cases we can get around that. But Kabbalah Samitzvos, we now get my point for you now, it's not about the Beis Din, but if that's what the Shulchan Aruch is saying about the Beis Din, we see that certainly Kabbalah Samitzvos is essential. Yes, Murray.
Yeah, says that you only tell him a few of the mitzvahs.
Good.
So what are you talking about when he has to say something more than
that? We're going to get to it. That's a good segue. That's exactly the section we're up to now. Okay, thank you. So the bottom line is, as Murray said quickly, it's impossible, even if a person goes to the best Geirus study group for a year, how much could they know? It's just impossible. Torah is a lifelong learning process. We know that. So the bottom line is, the Beis Din will ask them certain things, and obviously this is an example of subjectivity, different, but they did will ask different kinds of questions, but I can tell you in the case that I've been involved with, they're relatively serious questions. I've been part of a Beis Din that's asked about warming up food on Shabbos. You know, there's a certain expectation that at least in certain core areas, when that ger will walk out of the mikvah, they'll be able to at least live a basically observant life, even though they still have maybe much more to learn, but they'll already be ready. It could be Thursday. Shabbos could be coming up. You know, they need to know Shabbos as an example in Kashrus. And there could be some sophisticated questions. But one thing we're really trying to get at is not just how much they know, but what is their level of commitment. And if they're committed to doing everything they know, then the more they know, the more their commitment will spread. The more tricky questions are, what if we don't have full commitment? Not just not full knowledge, but full commitment. So until now, we've seen kind of the pure ideal, which is, of course, again, thank God, there are many cases where that's all you need, because the prospective convert is exactly that. This case that I went to in Silver Spring was the rabbi from Virginia came to meet with us, our regional Beis Din, and as we left, we had asked them certain questions, and we were only okaying them to begin the process. As the senior rabbi who was with me, who's done a lot more of these than me, said, he goes, I've been with people at the mikvah who already think they're at the end of a process, who don't know half as much as this couple knows when they're starting the process. As there are some people who are very sincere and become very knowledgeable and did a lot of self-reading and, you know, wonderful, but needless to say, that's not all the cases. That's not all the cases. So to what extent is there any wiggle room in this area? So I just want to give you a sampling. Again, we won't posket anything from the next 15 minutes, but I want to give you a little bit of a sampling of some of the wrinkles that are out there, and then I want to close the lecture with a reference to a very difficult position of the Rambam and a very beautiful and powerful explanation that Rav Soloveitchik quoted to that Rambam. So just to give you a sampling of some of the tshuvas in the real world, so to speak, struggling with less than ideal situations. So on the bottom of page 4, I have for you a very important tshuva of the Achi Ezer. The Achi Ezer is the book of tshuvas written by Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, who was the Gadol Ador, without a doubt, in Lita. In pre-war, he died shortly before the outbreak of World War II. He was in Vilna, was a great, great Dayan and Posek, and his tshuvas are contained in the Achi Ezer. Again, certainly not a lightweight. On the contrary, he was really the heavy hitter of his day. So he discusses the following case, and he says, listen, when we talk about mitzvos, what do we mean? He says, Kaven de makabel olav, kol mitzvos. If this person in the ger is accepting all the mitzvos, av shechoshev lahavar aleizem min a mitzvos achar kach l'teavon. Even if the moment they know that they're still going to be tempted by their yetzer hara to want to taste, whether that's literal or proverbial, the taste of sin, they'll want to still eat a cheeseburger, they'll want to do who knows what. Says Rav Chaim Ozer, you know, it could be mikol makom ein zemenil a kabbalas mitzvos. Maybe even if at the moment before they're converting, they still feel that way. They still feel weak. That may not be considered an inconsistency with kabbalas mitzvos. Only he says hecha shemasne shalol a kabbalah, where he's in a certain sense telling you, you know what? I don't accept this. I'm not going to do this. That's a chisaron ba kabbalas mitzvos. Now, if he would stop here, it would be a big chiddush, but at least it would be understandable. The problem is it continues in a way which makes sense in and of itself, but I'm still not clear how to put it all together. He says, Ulam, however, end of the second to last line. If it's absolutely clear, not that maybe he'll be tempted, but we know for sure that this person is definitely going to be violating Achareikein al-Suri Torah on serious Averos, Chilos Shabbos, Achilos Trefes, he's not going to keep kosher, he's not going to keep Shabbos, V'anu Yodin Be'erur Kavanoso, She'enu Mezgayer, Rak Lef, Nim V'libo B'chal Amo, Balimo, he's just saying he's converting, but really in his heart of hearts, he's not really willing to make the commitment. Hari umdina demuchach. So then we have an absolute clear presumption, Shemasha Omer, even though he's telling you, yes, 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 I accept the Torah, la plumu. He doesn't mean it. Imkein zechisarim b'kabal samitzvos dema'akev. In other words, if you have a case, he says, where you have a person who says all the right things, he answers the 10-question survey that you ask him at the mikvah, but you know, you'll tell me, how do I know? Because you know, you have common sense, you know the situation, you know where he lives, right? He's not going to be moving anywhere near a shul. How could he possibly be doing that? He's not living anywhere near a mikvah. There's no kosher meat anywhere near him. And he's not planning on making any effort to do it. You know for sure he has no intention, there's no chance he's going to keep kosher. Then it's a joke. Of course he's not being a kabbal mitzvos. On the other hand, he had said 2 lines before, well, if it's just a question of maybe he'll be tempted. Now, again, it's not clear to me what's the fine line he's trying to walk. He's clearly opening the door for some flexibility, but it seems like you better keep your finger out of that door because he slams it shut pretty quickly. It's not exactly clear what would be a middle case, because the two extremes are the easy ones, and he makes that clear. Someone who accepts everything is wonderful, and someone who is obvious won't be accepting major parts of Jewish life, that's also obvious, he says. But there's something in the middle where it's not clear to me exactly how to apply this, but at least in principle, he does have some form of an area in the middle. Let me share.
I thought that maybe what he means is that if you commit to keeping mitzvos, but you're over on mitzvos,
but what does he mean?
Doesn't call your original.
But what if? What about his continuation? Let's say you say, listen, I really am committed to committing mitzvahs, but I can't stop eating the non-kosher meat. I just love it so much.
If you eat a mitzvah with a ham and cheese sandwich in a brown paper bag, then it's a joke. But if you go out 2 weeks later and buy a ham and cheese sandwich...
But again, but what he says is... Correct, but what he says is, if the Beis Din has a strong feeling...
They saw the ham and cheese sandwich.
No, he didn't bring it. It means he didn't bring it. That's too obvious. But they know this person is not willing to forego that.
This person is walking out from the mikvah and from the session.
To celebrate their conversion at McDonald's.
Right, correct.
Okay. So that's an extreme case.
10 days later.
Okay.
It's not conditional. It's not conditional that the person is going to keep mitzvahs.
Well, that's the question. The answer is yes and no. That is the truth. I mean, again, There's nobody who's perfect. So we don't say that if the first sin that the ger ever commits, you know, wait, there's a custom that after the actual conversion, we try to have them do mitzvahs right away for the first time as obligated. So we'll give them a mizonos. I've been there, we'll give them a mizonos that they can make a bracha, you know, alamichya, then we will do a little hora. So let's say the person forgot his alamichya right away. We all know it could happen. Oh no, forgot a bracha. What are you going to say? What, all of a sudden they're not Jewish? Of course, that, you know, we don't say the first time they do an avera, it's conditional that they never do an avera. Of course not.
No, but if they convert on Thursday and on Saturday afternoon, they're from all.
Yeah, that might be a problem. That's exactly what he said. Again, it sounds like if they were committed to keeping Shabbos, but they woke up that Shabbos morning and, you know, the sale, buy me, you know, and they couldn't. So maybe, yes, that's a hard one to say yes, but maybe. But if the whole time, again, barbarities, you know, they never had, you know, they always knew, well, you know, I got to convert today because the rabbi's in town, but that sale on Thursday, yeah, Saturday, that may be a problem, actually. Yeah, yes, I think that would be a problem.
Macy's one day sale.
Okay. Let's take a look at three tshuvas of Rav Moshe Feinstein. The first one I have here actually is the earliest one. It's from before he came to America. He was in Lubavitch in Russia. Tough Reish Pink Test. What year is that? 1929. Okay, 1929. So here Rav Moshe writes unequivocally, very simple, straightforward. Pashut uborer she'eino ger klal af b'dieved v'chein hora Abba Mori, whose father's name was David, halacha lamaisa. If a person is not really mean it, they're insincere, of course it's nothing. Anan Sadish and a makabal of MS, if we know they're just a joke, they're going to walk out of the mikvah and they're not going to keep anything, or they're not going to keep nothing. And then he's very critical of the rabbis. Didn't start now. He's critical of the rabbis. What are the rabbis thinking who do these conversions? So what do they think they're helping the Jewish people with this? Don't they realize that a mixture of people who are completely insincere converts, so it's confusing. They think they're Jewish, but no, they're not. It's going to be a disaster. What are they thinking? Uladina Poshud Sheinze Ger Klal, he says, somebody who was insincere, never really committed to mitzvos, never had intention of being observant, and just went through the conversion, again, for marriage or for whatever reason, says Rav Moshe, it's nothing. Now, about 20 years later, I think, or so it was, he's now in America, and he gets a shaila about something he probably never heard of when he was living in Luban, called conservative Judaism. And he asked him about it. You see there on the first line, in case you were curious how to spell that, a rabbi conservativer. That's what he calls him. Eitzel rabbi. That's Reish Aleph Beis Yud Yud for you, yeah. Those of you scoring at home. Rabbi conservativer. So he's asked the same, in essence, the same question. And there he says, listen, how can you expect any more from the ger? How could they have Kabbalah and Mitzvos when the quote rabbi who's teaching them themselves don't have what we would consider sufficient Kabbalah and Mitzvos? And therefore he says, of course, he starts off by saying, of course it can't be good. However, which he's just reiterating his earlier tshuva. However, he then says, well, maybe in certain cases I can be malamed zchus, I can offer a defense for those who are willing to accept such converts. And he says here, he's referring to is a woman, I'm not sure if she was going to or was already married to a Jewish man. But the man wasn't religious at all, he wasn't Shabbos Shabbos. So how much more could you expect from his now newly Jewish, potentially, spouse? On the one hand, that's an obvious weakness. On the other hand, Rav Moshe suggests maybe it's also a defense. Because it could be, he says, I'm just going to read it outside, it's too long inside, it could be that really, 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 she is committed. She's committed to everything she's been taught. She's Mekabel Mitzvos. But she says, I want to keep Shabbos. I know the Jews mean they have to keep Shabbos. But what does Shabbos mean? Well, she knows from her husband. Shabbos means you wake up in the morning, I don't know, you turn on the TV, you go play golf. You know, you didn't go to work. And maybe it means I don't drive, but I do other things. Or maybe it means I drive to shul, but then I drive home. So she's Mekabel Mitzvah, she's Mekabel Shabbos. She says, this is all she knows. So maybe if she's really committed to everything that she knows, it's just that what she knows is obviously from our perspective is incorrect. Maybe he says that's sufficient. He's not so thrilled with it, and by the time he gets to the end, he says, well, Zehu Tam Sheish Bamamish, maybe this is a good explanation, Lachshiva Ligyores, to defend this woman's conversion, Hulimutz Chusksas al Rabbanim, again, it's to the Rabbanim, you know, maybe this is why the rabbis are accepting her, Shaloi Chashvod, Grimei Georges, and that's why maybe these rabbis should not be looked at as any worse than Ignoramuses. That's what you call a backhanded compliment.
But is the woman Jewish?
Bottom line, you mean would Ramosha say she's Jewish? I don't know. He throws out a svara, but he doesn't seem to really like it.
Rabbi.
Yes.
You don't even have a base in with the conservative or reformed. Or
yeah, that's
whatever.
Correct.
No, the Rabbanim on the bottom are based in, I think that's dealing...
Well, it was after the fact. It was after the fact, yes. It was after...
I don't think he's making fun of the Rabbanim on the bottom.
No, that's a different case, right? No, obviously, there has to be a case. Again, there were cases, especially in the earlier conservative movement, where you had Rabbanim who were themselves still Shomer Shabbos, etc. And there were some poskim, or Moshe generally was actually not one of them. But you had cases where there were poskim who were willing, whether it was in Geiris or in Gittin, sometimes on a case-by-case basis, to accept certain things done by the conservative rabbinate. But you're right, as a general rule, that could be an issue. This third tshuva of Rav Moshe is an interesting one. Shortly after the conversion, the Ger said, "Listen, I have to go into work on Yontif. If I don't, I'll lose my job." So Rav Moshe says, "Is that a problem?" So Rav Moshe says, "No. I mean, they're not allowed to. It's a problem to do it. But does that nullify the conversion?" He says, "No." He says, "Luyus says, let's say you had a case where a convert says, 'Listen, I accept all the mitzvos, but I know myself. If I would be one of those situations that the Gemara talks about where I had to give up my life rather than transgress idol worship, I don't have that strength. I would violate even though halacha tells me I should give up my life.'" So says our Moshe, "Would you say that such a person is not committed to mitzvos?" "Of course they have kabbalas mitzvos. They just are reflective and honest enough to admit that they're weak by applying it under the most stressful of conditions. But they're generally committed." So says Rav Moshe, in an unbelievable statement, "If that is true about willing to give up one's life," says, "an onus mammon, losing your parnasa, is also an incredibly stressful situation." Someone who says, at least in a one-time case, I don't know if it would be habitual, but this is a one-time case, someone who says, "As much as I know that I have to keep Yontif, and I know I can't go to work on Yontif, but what can I do? I'm weak. I don't have the faith to say, even if I lose my job, it's okay, I'll get another one." And therefore, with that fear hanging over them, they're going to go to work on Yontif. So Rav Moshe, that's a terrible avera, and because they're Jewish, they're going to get punished for going to work on Yontif. But it does not nullify
their perspective. Geir would tell the best right away.
Yeah,
it could not be the roots of Mikdash the second day as well.
Yes, sir. Moshe said that still would be a convert.
Not a convert.
Yes, no, or Moshe says it would be.
But that's a mitzvah like any other mitzvah.
Maybe that's exactly why. Yes, similar to the Achiezer, maybe because it's not principled. He says it explicitly. Take a look in the third one. He says explicitly. So again, Rav Moshe understands, because so that may be what the Rav Chaim Moses says, that that's not principled. That's just in a moment of weakness. As he knows he'll be weak, he won't be able to live up to it. But it's not that he's not accepting
that.
Exactly. Now, I just want to mention, before we get to the last part of the shir quickly, one of the sources that is often quoted in some of the recent literature, especially by a particular contemporary rabbi who's constantly agitating for more lax standards in Geiris, is a tshuva, it's a group of tshuvas really, by one of the former Sephardic chief rabbis in Israel, whose name was Rabbi Zion Meir Uziel. A very significant Sephardi Talmid Chacham, and he has tshuvas known as Mishpate Uziel, or a volume here called Piskei Uziel. And Rav Uziel, especially as this rabbi presents him, seems to take a different approach than everything we've seen until now. And basically makes the point, starting off very rational and then taking a big leap, says, "Listen, we don't expect that every convert will be Moshe Rabbeinu, or actually greater, because we'll never sin. Right? Then that we would never have any Geirim ever. So once that's true," which that's a very intuitive point, he says, basically at that point, he says, "we see from that that fulfilling mitzvos is not ma'akev. It's not necessary prerequisite. And therefore, if someone is not really committed, or we know for sure," he says, "even when we know for sure that they're not going to keep mitzvos, we can still convert them lechatchila, even ideally." Now, he does say this. Again, I don't want to, if you take a look on page 6, the top of the page, he does seem to say this. I think I'll read the last three lines. Mikol ha'amor ha'medubar, Torah yotzeh shemutar u'mitzvah, Lakabel gemru v'giyoris. It's a mitzvah to accept a convert. Afal pishi yadua lanu shelo yekaimu kala mitzvos. Now, his continuation seems to call that slightly in question, but he does have a number of statements of this vein, which seem to be very much against, really, the whole tradition that we have otherwise. And again, from that perspective, if you are comfortable with these terms, would be much more, if you will, liberal, or much more tolerant to this, much more flexible, I would say, is a better way of putting it. I'm not remotely convinced. First of all, because we don't have time for it, his language in this tshuva and his other tshuvas sometimes seems to be a little bit confusing. But furthermore, at the end of the day, unless someone is a consistent devotee of the Mishpatei Uziel, and that is their, no matter what comes, they're always l'kula l'chumra following him, to have him set the agenda for all Klal Yisrael, with all due respect, is to me just ridiculous. It's a significant Talmud Chacham, it's worth studying, I didn't hide it from you, I'm sharing it with you, but as you see, it's not remotely consistent with the general tradition. This is going way, way to the extreme. As we see Rav Chaim Ozer and Rav Moshe, and again, I'm just giving you small snapshots, there's volumes of tshuvas on these kind of topics, of poskim struggling with, is this enough, is that enough? But the implication implicitly of everything until then is, but of course you have to have Kabbalat HaMitzvos. And all of these cases are always vidyevit, after the fact, is it a good conversion, it's not a good conversion. But everyone, until other than him, seems to be holding, but of course, ideally you wouldn't convert someone that way, you shouldn't convert someone that way, of course you need Kabbalat HaMitzvos, that's ideal. But he does have some of these lines which seem to call all that in question. So whatever the explanation is, to, so to speak, use that as a platform to impact practically, Allah Kalamaisa, public policy, whether it's in Israel or America, to me seems to be very, very difficult. Maybe, I'm not even sure he's considered universally accepted in the Sfaradic community. I'm almost positive he's not. But the idea that it should have broader ramifications, as some have suggested to me, is just ridiculous. Yes, perhaps, yes. Again, everyone makes that distinction on some level, but he does it too literally, I guess.
Isn't it based on the fact that, even if they come on the Hillel sheets, and even as Rashi Tosfos has explained it, the fact that there may not be Kabbalah's mitzvahs now, but there's a reasonable possibility that there will be, and that's good enough.
But it wasn't just a reasonable possibility. Hillel was convinced.
No, so isn't that just a question of degree?
Yes, except the fact that, again, I'm not sure how much is Rav Uziel and how much is people who are, quote-unquote, using Rav Uziel, but they have used him, or they speak about using him in a context where it's far more extreme than that. People who you know aren't going to be keeping. The way he put it there, you know they're not going to keep. Is that what, Hillel had confidence that he would keep. He doesn't say you know he will keep, does he? And if it's not, would you use that tshuva to say somebody who ended up converting and spent the rest of their life is a not, as an... Then it's a nothing, right? So that's why I didn't get. And I said the end of this. I said the end of it actually calls into question, to some extent, the way people use him in a more liberal sense.
Does that mean they're not converts, or they're just they're doing a sin?
I guess it depends on how you read him. Okay, I want to finish in 6 more minutes, so let me just briefly summarize. We won't do all the sources that are left. Don't get worried. But I'll just mention to you one thing, because I think it's very, very important, because it's certainly reflective of what I think is more mainstream and more important. Aside from this Rav Uziel, we don't have time for it, but there's a huge academic discussion, huge literature on the Rambam's opinion. If you'll recall, I told you the Shulchan Aruch paskins that Kabbalah Samitzvos is absolutely integral. You need a Beis Din for it. That was based on Tosfos. The Rambam has a very difficult discussion of this topic and confusing. He actually gets into stuff which, just coincidentally, just this week I was learning Navi with my daughter. We were just learning about Shlomo HaMelech and all of the non-Jewish wives that he took at the end of his life. So Shimshon also had this problem. And the Rambam gets into this discussion in this context of, were they Jewish, were they not Jewish? Did they convert? Were they sincere converts? And in Shlomo HaMelech's case, as I was just learning with my daughter, they're doing Avodah Zarah in the palace. So, in the context of that discussion, the Rambam has a lot of confusing statements, perhaps even contradictory statements, but one thing in that discussion here, which I have here right after Roman numeral 5, he never really says anywhere that you have to have Kabbalah Samitzvos. Never says it. And in fact, in these cases with these women, he seems to assume that they're really Jewish, such as Jews who are worshipping Avodah Zarah, even though he says that they were insincere, that they only married those people because they wanted to be royalty, etc., and they had never given up their Avodah Zarah. After all, as we see, Sofot Mochichat Vlosan, as we see what happened as their lives progressed, they were worshipping Avodah Zarah. Now, based on all of that, it would have seemed, based on everything we've seen until now, that they're not good converts at all, they're not Jewish. But yet he still seems to say that they are Jewish. So it's very, very confusing, and it has led some, in my opinion, incorrectly, to say, oh, we have an Elon Gadol to hang our hat on. We can say the Rambam also holds that at least, again, Bidyevit, maybe you don't need some kind of a Kabbalah Samitzvos. People have been saying this for years, and of all places, in a famous philosophical essay, which we studied in a Moshe Shabbos lecture series, what was it, 3 years ago, when we discussed religious Zionism, the Rav Soloveitchik had a famous essay called Kol Dodi Do Fake. So in there he talks about Jewish identity and fate and destiny and all sorts of very pretty topics, but he has a long footnote, which if you have the Hebrew version is footnote 22, and an English version is footnote 24. I haven't got to the bottom of it, why it should change, it's just supposed to be a translation. But okay. But anyway, in that footnote, he quotes the Rambam, and he quotes the, those people who read this into the Rambam, that maybe you read Kabbalah Samitzvos, and then he says something very important, on which note we will end. And there's more here to see, but we'll just have to leave it to your own independent learning. We'll stop after we do this last source. He says, I once heard from my father and master, of Moshe Soloveitchik of blessed memory, that the Rambam does not mean to say that a person who converted with the intention of not observing the commandments is deemed a valid convert. And here's the important point. I started on my, I don't know if it came out on your sheet. This is the money line. Such a notion would subvert the entire concept of conversion and the holiness of Israel, which exhausts itself in our obligation to fulfill God's commandments. It's not just that that wouldn't be a good conversion. That's the least of it. To say such a thing, he says, makes a joke of the whole religion. The essence of the religion, and therefore the essence of converting and joining the religion, is Kabbalah Samitzvos, is being responsible and obligated and fulfilling to the best of one's ability the mitzvos. To convert without that commitment is a joke. It subverts, what do you say? The entire concept of conversion and the holiness of Israel. So what did the Rambam mean? So he points out what the Rambam was in essence telling us by not mentioning Kabbalah Samitzvos as part of the process of Geirus. Why was it not part of the process? Because it's far more important than that. Not because you don't need it, but because that is the essence of everything that you're doing. The process is the technicality, is the certain these specific things you have to do in order to achieve the goal. But that is the goal. He points out that Tosfos apparently understood that, even though that's true, it still has to be a formal part of the process. So the recording of the Rambam is far too important and too overwhelming to be reduced to just a specific part in the process. It is the essence of everything. And in fact, if you take a look, and with this we'll end, the Rambam earlier in the same chapter, he doesn't quote this, but it's an obvious proof to his contention. The Rambam, when he's describing what is conversion, before he gets to the process, before he gets to it, what does the Rambam say? V'chein l'doros, for all generations, k'siyirtza ha'akum l'hikaneis l'bris, a non-Jew wants to join the Jewish people, which is defined as, l'histofev tachas kanfei shchina, v'yekabel alav ol Torah. That's the definition of what it means to want to become a Jew. To accept upon themselves the responsibility and the yoke of Torah. Now, how do you do it? Tzarech mila, tefila, etc. So the fact that the Rambam doesn't count Kabbalah Samitzvos as part of the process, that according to the Rambam, perhaps if you didn't have a bezdin for it, it might still be okay. Which is a huge leniency as opposed to Tosfos, who required a bezdin. It's not because he felt it was less important, but because it was so important, it was an essential component of everything. Without that, there's nothing to talk about. You know, I could stand on my head, that doesn't make me a baseball player. I mean, what's it that you could go through all the process, but it's a complete joke to talk about conversion if you don't talk about Kabbalah Samitzvos. And again, this reflects, and with this will conclude, the duality of what I've been trying to stress since the beginning, which is that as much as we learn about conversion and the process of Geirus, it is at the same time teaching us about Judaism for all of us. convert or non-convert, because the way you become part of the group teaches us about what's important to the group. And therefore, Seder Salvation gets important. We know that part of the group, to, as we mentioned in the beginning, is to be part of the Jewish people and share in her destiny. And that's why you have the same history as all Jews if you become a convert. That's all true. But what's equally, if not more important, is the other aspect of conversion, which is definitional to everything. There's nothing to talk about without it. Namely, that it has to do with this relationship with Hashem, which as we define it, is not just some abstract spiritual high, which is maybe nice, but we view it, again, this is part of a larger, bigger discussion, which has nothing to do with the conversion, but our religious philosophy is that all that other stuff is nice, but insufficient, and it requires the rigor and the discipline and the commitment of mitzvahs. That is the definition of Judaism, and therefore it has to be the definition of conversion. To talk about one without the other, in some way that Rav Uziel may have been for Soloveitchik, wasn't just wrong, that'd be the least of it. It does violence to the whole nature of Judaism, let alone of conversion. So if with this conclusion we see how important the mainstream view, I believe, is of the role of Kabbalah Samitzvos and how essential it is, so now we'll have to turn our attention to the real facts on the ground, the real nitty-gritty difficult cases where we seem to have complications, namely when you have people converting for the sake of marriage, which does not necessarily seem to be the same thing as what I'm talking about, as well as children who are being converted where they themselves obviously can't commit, especially when you have cases of children being converted by families that aren't Shomer Shabbos, or from what extent, what acceptance can there be for such cases like that. Again, in light of this introduction, we'll be in a better place to analyze those cases the next 2 weeks. Thank you very much, and please don't let Marcia's efforts go to vain. Please take some food.
Thank you.
Please take something to drink. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.